Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. We are reaching a pandemic milestone in the coming days. This Saturday will mark 6 months from the date that the state of California issued the first statewide stay-at-home orders in the nation in response to the fast-spreading coronavirus. You remember this moment when life as we knew it changed dramatically for Californians.
There's a mutuality and there's a recognition of our interdependence that requires of this moment that we direct a statewide order for people to stay at home. That directive goes into force and effect this evening.
Governor Gavin Newsom there announcing back on the evening of March 19th the new directions to stay at home. Several Bay Area counties, you may recall, had already issued their own orders a few days earlier. And it was at the UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento where the first known case of community transmission for COVID-19 in the U.S. was being treated, and that happened in late February. Dr. David Lubarsky is the CEO for UC Davis Health. He's also the Vice Chancellor for Human Health Services, and he joins us now with a look at really how we've fared over the past half year. Dr. Lubarsky, welcome to Insight. Great to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, there was some conflicting information yesterday from the top levels of our national government regarding a vaccine timeline for COVID-19. Here's the head of the CDC, Dr. Robert Redfield, on what he sees viable, followed by President Donald Trump's reaction.
I think there will be vaccine that initially be available sometime between November and December, but very limited supply and will have to be prioritized. If you're asking me when is it going to be generally available to the American public so we can begin to take advantage of vaccine to get back to our regular life, I think we're probably looking at late second quarter, third quarter 2021.
No, I think he made a mistake when he said that. It's just incorrect information. And I called him. And he didn't tell me that, and I think he got the message maybe confused, maybe it was stated incorrectly. No, we're ready to go immediately as the vaccine is announced, and it could be announced in October, could be announced a little bit after October, but once we go, we're ready.
Dr. Lubarsky, you run one of the top medical facilities in the nation. Do you think we'll have a vaccine available for at-risk people on that timeline?
On Robert Redfield's timeline, I certainly do. Unfortunately, the interchange between our president and the head of the CDC encapsulates much of what the entire problem has been with this nation's response to the pandemic. And so, I think that there will be a successful vaccine candidate identified, or hopeful that there will be. I'm confident that eventually it will be shown to be safe and effective. And I'm equally sure that it will not be sufficiently widely distributed to achieve the type of herd immunity that would cut the pandemic out of our society in short order.
Has the messaging complicated your operations there at the UC Davis Medical Center?
It has complicated things at the medical center only because we continue to get people who don't understand the most simple basics about trying to stay healthy, because there are conflicting messages from the top and certainly no role modeling when you congregate large numbers of people inside of closed spaces. It's absolutely critical that we do what we've been saying all along and that other societies, whether it's Taiwan or France, have done successfully, which is to pursue open air solutions, to mask when you're within 6 feet of someone else, and then to practice hand hygiene and really enforce physical distancing whenever out in public. It's just really not complicated, and the rest of the world has gotten it right. And Robert Redfield also said that wearing a mask would be more important than actually getting a vaccine at this point in time in order to cut the top off this pandemic. And he was absolutely right.
Dr. Lubarsky, as I mentioned at the top of the show, UC Davis, the UC Davis Med Center had that first patient that we knew of anyway, where the COVID-19 was passed through the community. What has your organization learned in the 6 months It's a little more than 6 months now since you first started treating that patient who was successfully treated. What have you learned in those 6 months regarding treatment of COVID-19 and, you know, how we can keep everything under control?
All right. Well, there's a couple of things. The first thing that we learned, and we learned this, as you said, more than 6 months ago, which is that rapid and accurate diagnostic tests allow you to take the best care of patients, protect the frontline workers, and allow people to make the right decision around quarantining themselves. The mess around testing that led to massive delays really actually allowed the virus to spread because most people would not self-quarantine or take themselves out of the workforce while they waited for an accurate test to come back. The second thing we learned is that the federal government, frankly, was woefully unprepared for a challenge to the public health at this level, and that it was similarly ill-prepared in its testing algorithms and testing supplies and other types of supplies to keep us all safe. And we have spent a great deal of time perfecting our own supply chain and developing our own testing capacity, so we are self-sufficient in that regard. But not every health system is, and nor should every health system have to be. And we've learned how important the federal government is to be functional.
Doctor, we've had this choking smoke in the Sacramento region for weeks now. And, you know, a lot of people want to put on an N95 mask when they go out to protect against that particulate matter. We're told we shouldn't do that because we need to save the masks for frontline workers there at the hospital and such. You just mentioned, protecting your own supply chain and such. How are we with masks?
I'm happy to say that at least we keep track of this twice a day, at least at UC Davis Medical Center and frankly at all the University of California medical centers. We all have in excess of 42 days of protective personal equipment and are well prepared to protect patients and staff through the oncoming flu season. There's a however. If everybody wore an N95 mask in the population to protect against the smoke, and to be honest with you, that is not an unreasonable desire when you are A, unhealthy or the PM 2.5 gets above 200, we would quickly deplete supplies. Mm. So it's not ideal, frankly, and it's a bad confluence of events.
Yeah. So over the past 6 months, I imagine that you've made notes of things that you've done right, and you've made some notes of things that perhaps you didn't do right. What would you change if you could over the past 6 months?
Well, the first thing would be if we learned the lessons from other societies, and actually, I think we made a really bad mistake around telling people not to wear masks at the very beginning. We did that because we were afraid we didn't have enough masks for the healthcare workers. But in point of fact, the way that the virus spreads, and this is pretty clear now, it's not airborne except with respiratory droplets, meaning on your spit, on your saliva, when you sneeze, when you cough, when you shout and scream. And that is the way that it spreads. And when you put a mask on yourself, you don't spread the virus. Mm. And when you put a mask on yourself, you also don't inhale or ingest the virus. And so the other thing we've made a terrible mistake around is saying that masks are not protective of you when you wear them. You are protected. You're not perfectly protected. But again, the way that the virus spreads is the amount of virus particles that you're exposed to. And if you cross a certain threshold, you're more likely to get the disease. If you wear a mask or you're outdoors, you are less likely to be around a high concentration of virus particles around your nose and mouth, and you will less likely get the disease. So everybody should wear a mask when close to other people or indoors.
Dr. David Lebarski is the Vice Chancellor for Human Health Services and CEO for UC Davis Health. Doctor, thank you so much for being here this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
And then from one doctor to another, we now head to Dr. Olivia Carcerier is Sacramento County's public health officer, and she joins us now for maybe some more granular information. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
So early on, Sacramento was praised for how its residents flattened, some even said crushed the curve. But then over the summer, as you know, the numbers really shot up. The latest numbers show we are on a downward trend again. Doctor, can you give us your take on how we're really doing 6 months in?
That is correct. We did, after being able to successfully bend the curve in April, we started seeing an increase in cases the beginning of June, and that peaked by the end of July, where we were getting as many as 300 cases per day. Mm. And there's been a steady decline since then. And actually last week, for the first time in 2 months, our total number for the entire week was less than 1,000. It was a total of 817. So that definitely is a step in the right direction. And also, when you look at our hospitalizations from a high of close to 300, now we're seeing about 127 in our hospitals. So we're definitely heading in the right direction, but we still have a way to go.
So those numbers, how does Sac County stand when it comes to the new state-based tier levels? Right now, I know we're in that purple zone, which is the most restrictive. What do we have to do? Are we doing what we need to do to get to the red zone?
We are doing what we need to do, which is the advice that we've given to individuals about what they can do when they're going outside to make sure that they use the face covering, keep 6 feet separation from other people, and hand sanitize. Also reminding people to stay home if they are feeling sick. And also for businesses, unfortunately, a lot of the businesses have had to either stay closed or have to operate outside. But we've had to do that in order to limit the movement of people. And the last thing also is the reduction in number of gatherings, because at the beginning, we were seeing that the increase was being driven largely by people gathering either indoors for private parties or funerals and weddings, and that actually drove up our cases. And we've seen that that has reduced a lot, and that has helped us. So according to the tier process that the state has established, we are in tier one, and we need to get our case rate down. Right now, from the last update that we got this week, our case rate, daily case rate is 9 per 100,000. We need to get that to below 7. Mm. And at the rate that we've been going, we feel that we can make that within the next couple of weeks. And our positivity rate is at 5.7%. And so we have hit the mark to be able to move into tier two, but the case rate also needs to go down before we're able to move.
So Dr. Carcerier, maybe by mid-October, we could possibly move into that red, if things continue on the current trend, we might be able to move into that red tier?
We're very hopeful that with the current trending, that will be there by mid-October.
What would you say has made the biggest difference in terms of stabilizing the spread of COVID-19 in Sac County?
Definitely it's the people listening to our message in terms of stopping the gatherings, in terms of taking precautions when they're out in the public. And we also appreciate the businesses that are doing the right thing and following the health officer order that we have put out.
In just a couple of seconds, when you're out and about, people may not know who you are. Do you see things that you know, encourage you, or do you see things that make you go, oh, geez?
For the most part, I am very encouraged when I go to different businesses and I see that people are using face coverings, that they have signs that show where people need to stand, and people that are obeying and compliant to all of the orders that they are given. There are times, yes, when I go to certain places where people are not so careful.
Right. I gotta stop you there, Doctor. Dr. Olivia Carcerier is Sacramento County's public health officer. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Up next, we head to the largest school district in Northern California for an update on how this very unusual school year is going. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today is a look at what we've learned 6 months after our initial lockdown due to COVID-19. The anniversary for the half-year mark is this Saturday. Schools, as you know, went mostly virtual in the middle of spring as a way to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Now schools are still on that path, at least most schools, as they navigate the best way to continue to provide students with a proper education while keeping those children, teachers, and staff safe. One of the largest school districts in the state is the Elk Grove Unified School District, and its superintendent, Christopher Hoffman, joins us now. Welcome to Insight. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Boy, what a challenge you faced heading into the fall. How do you feel it's gone so far?
I think the fall has actually got off to a really great start. We actually start a little bit earlier than most because we have year-round schools that actually started earlier than most. So we've been at this now for several weeks. And I do think the promise that we made to our community that we would have a significant improvement over what we were able to offer in the spring, I think the staff has stepped into that space and met that challenge.
How is the district dealing with the burnout and struggles from students who just really want to be back in that classroom atmosphere?
Yeah, well, the reality is everybody wants to be back. I mean, our teachers, our principals, everybody wants, and I've been out to every single one of our 67 schools over the past few weeks. And while everybody's working extremely hard and doing great work, the energy of the kids is just missing. So everybody is missing that component. I will say we are doing a great deal of work in making sure that we're paying attention to the social emotional needs of our students and our staff. As we did training for the start of this school year, we did a significant amount of work on obviously technology and being able to deliver online curriculum. But half of the work that we did was actually on social emotional learning and being able to connect with kids in this new environment, identify kids who might be having challenges more than just with the instruction, but actually coping. And so we have a great deal of resources through our mental health therapists, our counselors, and we're actually doing that work sometimes virtually, and sometimes we're having to actually visit the homes and check on our kids and make sure they're okay. So it's at the top of our minds for sure.
Yeah. Superintendent, when you have a district that is as large as yours, you certainly cover many socioeconomic demographics within that district. And I'm wondering, I know that a struggle going into this and a struggle to this day for many districts is making sure that each student is able to, as you touched on there, access the technology in an equitable fashion. How do you feel Elk Grove Unified has met that?
And so we've distributed literally tens of thousands of Chromebooks to our kids. Any family that has needed that technology, they have it. We've gotten that to them. We've also, it's been a big uptick this fall, is we've also distributed thousands of hotspots to make sure kids can connect as well. So from the technology standpoint, I think we've met that challenge. We actually have done an additional order of Chromebooks and technology, because when the transition model happens and kids come back, right now it's kids that have asked for needed technology. But when everybody comes back, people moving back and forth, we're probably going to have to distribute a Chromebook to every single kid in the district. And we're setting ourselves up to be able to do that as we move forward.
I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Dr. Carcerier on the previous segment, but she was saying that there's a possibility Sacramento County could move into the red tier as early as mid-October. I believe it's at that point, right, that schools then can consider some level of in-classroom instruction?
Yes, yeah, so we have a transition model that we actually were fully ready to put into place going into the start of the school year when, and this has been the rally cry that just happened this whole process, is, and things changed. And all of a sudden, so the governor, you know, made the declaration that everybody was going to be on a distance learning. We'd actually made that decision a few days ahead of that just because we saw the conditions weren't going to be right for bringing kids back. So we're in the process of, you know, refining what we call the transition model, because our goal is to get all kids back at some point. So
at least like a few days a week, right?
Yeah, people are using the term hybrid, and I said, I don't want to hear the word term hybrid anymore because people had a bad taste about it. Right. I said, I have a hybrid club in my golf bag, but we're doing a transition model as we move kids from distance learning to all the way back. And now we'll probably have what we're terming a pre-transitional model. And we're working on that right now to be able to do testing for our special needs students and for our English language learners, and to ideally be able to bring back small groups of high need students to be able to do some of the educationally related services and be able to provide those on our campuses. So it's just a continuum of services with the goal of getting everybody back, but there'll be some steps in getting to that final goal.
What do you think the toughest decision your district or yourself that you've had to make over the past 6 months?
Well, the decision people always want to talk about was the first decision. Right. So it was the Saturday, the 7th, when we made the decision that and kind of before others were seeing the same things we were seeing, and we had a couple of different pieces of information that were unique to us. So that initial decision to close schools that the week of first week there in March was probably the most challenging initial decision. I will say I actually slept a little better that night, knowing our kids and our staff were going to be safe for this next week, you know, while we gathered more information to figure out what the rest of the spring was going to look like. But that was a tough decision. And there were some folks that were supportive right from the start, and there were some other folks that were less gracious, let's
right.
say.
Nice way to
and,
put it.
Yeah. So I heard from all of them. But in the end, I think it was clear that it was the right decision at the time. And in Maine, the big deal in the first piece, we just needed more time to make a long-term decision, and that's what we did initially.
Yeah. Superintendent Christopher Hoffman with Elk Grove Unified School District. So depending on where you cut the state in half, Fresno could either be in Northern or Southern California. If you put it in Southern California, then Elk Grove Unified is the largest in Northern California. That's pretty impressive. But I think you fall, if I have this correctly, you fall fifth in the state in terms of size. That's big. Yeah.
Yeah. The 63,000 kids and 7,000 plus adults and everybody attached to them. And it's, the other thing with Elk Grove, that's a little bit different. Some of the big districts are a little bit more condensed, but we also cover 300 plus square miles. And so that, it's geographically a large district too.
Rural and urban, right. Superintendent, yep. Thank you so much for updating us today, and good luck moving forward through the semester.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much. Take care.
Restaurants and bars also, of course, shut down indoor dining back in the spring. Some places closed their doors for good as the outlook of surviving the financial hardships that came along with COVID-19 just looked too grim. Back in May, we checked in with the owner of Mountain Slice Cafe and Creamery in Tahoe City. Owner Alex Hunt got creative with how he would do business by making a do-it-yourself pizza kit. Alex is with us again today to give us an update on how business is going and if people are still into those home pizza kits. Great to have you with us, Alex.
Hey, how you doing, Randall? Nice to talk with you. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. How have you adjusted business since you were last on Insight?
So I believe last time we had talked in May, we were kind of transitioning back into the takeout-only thing with the county kind of shutting itself back down. And we, you know, then everything was good. The pizza kits were selling great. People were really, really taking advantage of it and really trying to take advantage of the time they're spending with family. So really just getting that good family time in and doing some projects and cooking together. And so that was great. Recently, the county has opened back up again with limited capacity for the restaurants.
What, you can do 25%, right?
Yes, sir. We can do 25%.
Indoor.
Yeah, indoor. And so for us here at Mountain Flights, we're a real small facility here, a real small restaurant with only a couple tables inside. So it's not that great for us because we can't really have that many people in here anyway.
So person sits down and you're at 25%?
Pretty much. You have like 3 to 4 people in here, and then we're pretty much maxed out. So the takeout game for us when everything did shut down was great. Everybody, you know, typically does takeout as far as pizza goes. That's kind of the mode of transportation for it. And for us, we really didn't see a huge decrease in sales. As far as the numbers go, the window service was great. Everyone was able to walk up. And because we're positioned right here on the main road in Tahoe City, we're able to, you know, get a lot of the foot traffic that's coming on. And now that everything is opening back up, we are starting to see, you know, some people walking around a little bit more in town. However, currently we are dealing with all the closures of the trails and the campsites and all the state-run parks right now because of the fires that are going on. And so we are definitely feeling a little bit of a slowdown from that. But as far as the grand scheme of everything goes, we're doing not too bad right now.
Yeah, the smoke levels there at Lake Tahoe really spiked in the last few days. So I imagine people are hunkering down indoors. They don't want to go out much.
No, a lot of people, you are totally correct. A lot of people are staying indoors and kind of trying to do a lot more things inside, which, you know, we're seeing a decent amount of sales for to-go pizzas, which is great. The main thing that we are really struggling with here now in town is we're seeing a pretty bad housing crisis going on with the big move for a lot of remote working.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. So we're seeing a lot of people coming in from San Francisco and outside towns that wouldn't have been able to be here otherwise, and now that they're able to remote work, the second homeowners up here are selling their houses, and which is understandable, but it's really starting to put a hurt on the workforce, and we're having a hard time retaining employees with just the huge influx of people that we've seen up here. And that's really kind of what we're struggling with, as we do see ourselves as a tourist-driven town, and we are very seasonal. Once slow season starts and the housing becomes even harder to find, then, you know, our backs are up against the walls as employers, and for the employees here that have been, you know, in the community, contributing to the community for the last few years, are now finding themselves being priced out, and it's unfortunate. You know, we're really kind of grasping at straws to try to keep our workforce up here.
Alex, on a bright side of that, though, does having a more permanent residence base help during the bridge season, which we're heading into, that, you know, that period of time between skiing and summer activities? You know, since it's not so transient, do you have a better base of customers?
So I will say that it has been a little bit more steady. I believe the numbers are the school system up here saw a increase of, I believe, like something close to 300 new students.
Oh wow! Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it's definitely something that you see when you drive around town now. The roads are a little bit more busier. You're seeing cars a little bit more on the sides. We're seeing a little bit more people coming in. We're starting to garner some new local following, which is awesome. We love it. We definitely love it, and we will take that with open arms. We just want to try to find some sort of a balance. And so, you know, if we can reach out to the community and you know, reach out to the county and see what we can do, that's really what we can do, because that's going to really help sustain the local business up
right here.
And that's what we want to do. And we love this community, and the community loves what we do here. And
I think everybody loves that community.
Yeah, I mean,
no matter where you are.
Oh man, the support that we get up here from everybody that comes into town is phenomenal, and we can't thank the people enough for helping us get through all this COVID time. And it has been a rough summer, but everybody helped make it through, and we really do appreciate that.
And that's Placer County that Tahoe City is in. And it, despite the name city, it's not incorporated, right?
No, sir. It is
yeah.
Not.
So, hey, well, best of luck to you, Alex. I hope everything goes well. Mountain Slice Cafe and Creamery owner Alex Hunt in Tahoe City there. We really look forward and hope you just have a great season as you move ahead.
Thank you. Check back in with me, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Still ahead, a high-profile musician is joining the staff of instructors at Sac State during a time when the arts are really struggling. 6 months into this pandemic shutdown, we will have that bright spot coming up. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. The arts community is reeling from 6 months of pandemic shutdown. There's a lot of creativity out there to keep it alive in these less than ideal circumstances. Artists and musicians are still practicing their skills. Students are learning and teachers are teaching. In fact, this semester, the Department of Jazz Studies at Sacramento State University is welcoming a high-profile addition to its teaching staff. Saxophonist Brian Landris, who specializes in teaching jazz improvisation and arranging, recently visited with Cap Radio Jazz Music Director Gary Vercelli.
Brian Landris comes to Sac State with excellent credentials as a music educator and recording artist. In addition to teaching at Rutgers University in New Jersey for the past 5 years, he's been a busy performer in the jazz capital of the world, New York City. Earlier this year, Landris released his 10th album as a leader, which features jazz luminaries Fred Hirsch and Billy Hart, and spotlights his lyrically fresh, original compositions. We would eventually discuss the challenges of teaching remotely at Sac State, but first I was curious about how his latest project came together. Landris said he followed the advice of his mentor, trombonist Bob Brookmeyer.
Bob always told me that you need to book the session before you have the music and just make sure it happens. Just make it happen. And so that's what I did. And I called up the amazing musicians, friends of mine, and we booked the date, and then I started writing the music. I was lucky enough to have Fred Hirsch play piano on it, and Fred and I talked a lot, and he was very curious about what music I was writing, and he kept asking me when he agreed to do it. He said, "Could you send me the music?" And I said, I certainly will, but I don't have any of it written. And so he would, you know, hit me up and say, you know, can you send me some tracks here? What are we doing? So I wrote all this stuff in less than a month and then just sent him all the music and we started working on it. And then when I wrote the music, I was hearing string quartet. And once I decided that we would add the string quartet, things just kept getting thicker and thicker. And it just turned into a really beautiful project.
Well, it's a beautiful contrast to have the baritone saxophone, which is your main voice, contrasting with the strings. Baritone saxophone has not been a personal favorite of mine, just because I've kind of been raised listening to the tenor, and sometimes the baritone just has sort of an aggressive sound to it, but I don't sense that in your playing. You seem to have a more gentle delivery on the baritone. Is that conscious, or is just your way of expressing yourself?
I was really a tenor player. I picked up baritone when I was 18, but I didn't fully switch over to embracing that I was supposed to be a baritone player till I was 23. And at that time, I had already, I'd say, developed more of a romantic concept of the instrument, where I wanted it to be beautiful. And I don't want it to be something that's just supposed to be necessarily a masculine, aggressive sound. That's not at all what I want. The musicians and artists that I gravitate towards on all instruments, whether it's Billie Holiday or Harold Land, it's the beauty of tone. And so I've always just had the approach of trying to get the most gorgeous sound out of the instrument as possible. And that really comes through just from playing long tones and just notes for a very long time and listening and trying to emulate a cello. I practiced for many years playing the Bach cello suites on the instrument and just trying to embody that large sound and gorgeous tone of a cello.
Well, you've achieved something similar on the bass clarinet. Not since Eric Dolphy have I heard someone tackle something like Round Midnight in the manner you did.
Bass clarinet actually feels like my main voice nowadays, and that happened a few years ago where everything I was hearing just was bass clarinet. When I would go to play something, I would write a lot of the music and I would write it on bass clarinet, and it just has this earthy, beautiful sound. Round Midnight has always been one of my favorite songs since I started playing it when I was probably 14, 15 years old, and it's such a gorgeous song that I was trying to think, I wanted to play it and then with the band, and then I just thought more and more about it, and I thought maybe I should just go into the studio and try a cappella and just see if I can get something that's trying to play the bass line, trying to outline the chords and play the melody at the same time, so you could hear the structure of the song and which Monk did such an incredible job writing.
We're talking with Brian Landress, Assistant Professor of Jazz Studies at Sac State. And Brian also has a new album out called For Now. Tell me about the challenges of teaching remotely. And is this the first time you've had to do that?
I've actually taught quite a bit over the internet over the last 5 years, working with Skype, Zoom, WebEx. And then when COVID hit, I was teaching these really large classes at Rutgers using the online technology. So, you know, I've become used to it, and some things lend themselves much better to teaching over the internet than others. And for instance, teaching composition actually works quite well because you can have the student send you the music, go over them, listen together, and then work things out and give a lot of suggestions. So that's fantastic, actually. It works really well. But some of the stuff that's tough is some of the instrumental issues, such as, you know, hand placement, embouchure, really the things that you need to be in the room to look at their hands. So sometimes I find myself, even today, where I had to have this student, I say, you know, could you move over a little so I can see what you're doing with your left hand? And, you know, can you lean in a little so I can see your flute embouchure, for instance? I think, you know, another really hard part is I really enjoy the community aspect. And when you're teaching classes like jazz improvisation, it's it's hard to build that community rapport without having everyone sitting in the same room together. So there are challenges, but I think the good news is a lot of the people have adapted already, and I know a lot of the faculty at Sac State has become quite experienced with this as well. So we're adapting and trying to make it a really, really positive experience for the students.
What are some of the classes you're teaching at Sac State, and how large are your classes?
My classes are quite small, which is wonderful. I'm teaching jazz improvisation, which has 8 students right now. And I'm teaching jazz arranging, which is also a composition course, and there's 9 students in that. And then I have a private studio where I'm teaching composition and woodwinds, flute, saxophone, clarinet. So it's, and then also I'm teaching a jazz history course. It's a lot of really wonderful material. So it's just, it's absolute joy to be able to teach this to students.
We're talking with Brian Landris, and Brian, you've got some pretty impressive, talented friends, Billy Hart, Drew Gress, Fred Hirsch. Are you going to miss that sort of access to top drawer talent by moving to Sacramento?
Well, I'm certainly going to keep one foot in the door at all times. So I'm planning on keeping my place out here in Brooklyn and coming back quite a bit to play. And that all seems actually kind of silly right now, considering the situation in the world. But I really hope that changes. I'll find a way. And I've already talked to Steve Roach at Sac State to get some of these people out as guest artists. So that'll be a beautiful way to get these students to meet these luminary artists. And someone like Billy Hart, who's played with everyone, you know, from Blondie to Miles to everyone in between, it's pretty incredible the amount of people he's played with. And so we'll be bringing people out like Billy to work with his students, which is going to be a wonderful experience for them.
Well, Brian, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to meeting you in the flesh when you get out here to Sacramento. And I'm really looking forward to you bringing out some of the high-profile colleagues. I think it'll be great for the students here.
Oh, thank you so much, Gary, for having me. It's an honor to talk to you. And I was going to say, how long have you been on the air?
Oh, just 40 years here.
Okay, I didn't want to sound stupid by saying this, but I remember when I lived in Reno listening to you all the time. And it's really an honor to talk with you. So thank you for promoting this music for so many years.
Seems strange introducing him, but that's Cap Radio Jazz music director Gary Vercelli, so you need to hear that. And saxophonist Brian Landris, who is a new addition to the staff at Sac State. So find out more about any of the guests that you heard from today here on Insight at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and a welcome to Megan Manada. Our technical director is Mark Jones, engineer Antonio Munez, Insight's managing editor Aram Sarkissian, who I think you're going to hear in just a second here. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. As always, thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.